It's Lars Larson. Thanks for listening to my podcast and for listening to the Lars Larson Show. Happy Monday from the Radio Northwest Network. It is a pleasure to be with you. Glad to supply some honestly provocative talk radio for the Pacific Northwest. And we'll keep an eye on what's going on around the world as well, because President Biden has just put 8,500 troops on high alert because of what's going on in Ukraine. And then his Pentagon spokesman just finished saying, literally minutes ago, but we're not going to send any of them to Ukraine. But they're supposed to intimidate Vladimir Putin against invading Ukraine, even though the president has already said that they're not going to Ukraine. And the president of Ukraine was more than a little bit critical of Joe Biden because he said, hey, President Biden is telling all the Americans to come home from Ukraine. The president of Ukraine said something that you would expect to be a little bit of hyperbole. He said, heck, they're in more danger in American cities than they are here in Ukraine. So the president of Ukraine said they're safer here in Ukrainian cities than they are at home in American cities. Now, you might be thinking, well, he's talking about Chicago or Washington, D.C. or Miami. No, actually, we looked up the numbers. It turns out that Portland, Oregon, and Seattle are much more dangerous by the numbers in terms of violent crime than the major cities of Ukraine. So turns out he's right, and it makes it a little bit ironic. We're bringing Americans home from Ukraine because it's too dangerous to be there, and yet American cities, many of them, are more dangerous than that. But in any case, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the past 22 years with honestly provocative talk, the most interesting conversation that you'll have in talk journalism. And you're welcome to take part as well. If you want to jump in, it's 866-HEY-LARS. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can vote in our Twitter poll because just a few hours ago, the Supreme Court of the United States had decided that it's going to take on a case that could literally affect you, your family, your son, your daughter, your grandson, your granddaughter. And here's the way we frame the question, because this is the question the U.S. Supreme Court will consider. Should the court ban American colleges from giving preference to students based on skin color? And if you're saying to yourself, no, no, we live here in the woke Pacific Northwest, we're as politically correct as the day is long, why, none of the universities here could be doing that. The Supreme Court case that they're taking up actually deals with two major universities, Harvard and the University of North Carolina. They are both being brought up before the Supreme Court because those universities discriminate in favor of some students and against other students based on their skin color and their racial background. And they will take that case up. We likely won't hear a decision in it till June. But if you ask yourself, why does this affect me or my family? Because right now, American colleges and universities do discriminate based on skin color. And I'm going to get into that a little bit later in some of the commentary today, because I thought we always wanted to have a colorblind society. It's what Dr. Martin Luther King used to talk about when he said he wanted to be judged based on the color, based on the content of his character, rather than the color of his skin. And yet Harvard and UNC actually discriminate against Asian American students. They discriminate in favor of Black and Hispanic students, and white kids, yeah, they get some discrimination as well. But the Supreme Court will decide whether or not to shoot that down. And it comes at an interesting time, as I told my colleague from Seattle, John Carlson, this morning, because Governor Jay Inslee of Washington State, he's not paying any attention to what the voters have said about affirmative action. Voters in the Evergreen State two decades ago said, we do not want discrimination by state agencies based on skin color. And yet the legislature and the governor have said, well, we do want that kind of discrimination. So we're going to get into that as well. Today's Twitter poll can be found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, last week, we spent a considerable period of time talking about the fact that the Oregon Health Authority was holding a hearing. Now, they called it a public hearing. More than 100 members of the public showed up, and they said, we do not want a permanent rule on wearing a mask indoors in the state of Oregon. The state right now has a temporary rule, but that temporary rule runs out in February. They could renew the temporary rule, especially since right now the COVID pandemic appears to be winding down, and we can get into the details of that this week. Now, let me tell you what happened in last week's hearing. I mentioned it on the show. More than 100 citizens showed up to testify, and they said, all 107 of them said, we do not want you to adopt a permanent rule. Not one person testified in favor of the permanent rule. And yet here's a state government agency saying, we want to adopt a permanent rule. And then they went into this weirdness that was actually the mainstream media, for the most part, carried water for them, saying, well, they call it a permanent rule, but it's really not a permanent rule because they could always change it someday. Well, that's true of every rule that you adopt. I mean, even rules adopted in the Constitution, in the Bill of Rights, are I guess, by one set of logic, are not permanent because they can be changed. But if you follow that kind of logic, then nothing is permanent. Well, now the Oregon Health Authority is actually holding one hearing that's going on right now, and a second one that will happen today as well, to talk about putting masking inside of schools and healthcare settings in place, as they say, indefinitely. In other words, they want to adopt a permanent rule. Now, if the proposals are adopted, this is the way K2, which is Como's sister station, TV station here in Portland, health officials say they would not be in place forever. Well, there's no guarantee of that. They're going to put them in place, and they could be changed at some point. But the reporters who cover this, K2 actually wrote, the idea is to keep them in place so the state does not have to extend the current rules every 180 days. Officials said they would repeal them once they deem them no longer necessary. In other words, unelected bureaucrats working within the state-level swamp get to decide, not the people's representatives, not somebody you can vote for or vote against at the next election. People whose names you don't even know will make that decision once they deem the rules are no longer necessary. Now, I would love to talk to the naysayers as well. We should let them adopt these permanent rules. As far as I'm concerned, I'd love to see them forced to readopt them every 180 days and justify them based on the circumstances at that point. If you're following the news about COVID in the United States, the pandemic is ebbing right now. It is going down to a different level. It'll probably become an endemic, meaning the disease will be there. We have treatments for it. We have antivirals. We have monoclonal antibodies. Two-thirds of the country has been vaxxed. So will citizens tolerate the draconian demands of the government that says, we're going to put a permanent rule in place. We will decide. Unelected bureaucrats will decide whether you need that rule anymore or not, and we will let you know our decision. You have nothing to say about it. Does that sound kind of familiar these days? Coming up in a moment, America once stood for a colorblind society. Not so much lately in these woke times, and now the Supreme Court is going to take up that challenge. I've got a few thoughts on that coming up next on the Radio Northwest Network.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
Most Americans, I would say, want a colorblind society. You know, judging individuals by the content of their character and not the color of their skin, as Dr. Martin Luther King once said, famously, by the way. Democrats and too many American colleges love to judge students based on skin color. I figure they likely do the same to their faculty and staff. This morning, the U.S. Supreme Court announced it is taking up a case that is right on point. You see, many, if not most, colleges use skin color to determine who gets in and who does not. Now, if that sounds racist, I would agree with you. It is racist. Lower test scores qualify black and brown applicants. White kids need higher grades, and Asian kids, they have to score the highest just to get a seat in the classroom. Anybody who thinks that's fair is welcome to call this show as a naysayer and explain the logic. Why should we have different sets of standards for different kids applying to college based on what color their skin is, who mom and dad and grandma and grandpa were? If that makes sense, I'd love to hear a naysayer not sound like a Klansman as they explain that argument. The Supreme Court takes up the cases out of Harvard and the University of North Carolina, where colleges argue that race-based admission decisions are fair. The court's latest decision on this subject was 7 years ago, but fortunately since then, two of the most liberal members of the court have now departed. One died, the other one simply retired. I'm looking forward to good news on this one. Despite having Jim Crow Joe Biden in the White House, I think America is ready to live up to Dr. King's words and let kids get into class based on their scholarship and not based on their skin tone. On Getter, Ms. Mitchell writes in, Lars, not everybody in Oregon is abiding by the mask mandate. Some folks recognize this tyrannical introduction for what it really is. As more folks wake up and stop wearing masks when they're out dining and shopping, then even more people will join in. I refuse to wear a mask when I go out, she writes. I'm surprised at how many compliments I get simply based on my smile. And honestly, many of those compliments are coming from the employees of the store. On Facebook, and I withheld the name at the request of the writer, Lars, our misguided leaders in Oregon threaten to fire healthcare workers that refuse the vaccine. As some leave, the remaining nurses are overworked due to short staff, causing even more of them to quit. As a result, our nieces, the two who are ER nurses at different hospitals, tell us that our hospitals are, quote, full because they don't have enough staff to make all the beds available. In fact, the McMinnville Hospital is considering temporarily shutting down due to insufficient staffing. Our Democrat leaders never cease to amaze me as to how stupid they can be. They try to force people to take an experimental vaccine that does not prevent communication of the disease. The cascading effect is insufficient health care during a time when it's needed the most, and I withheld the name from that one. On Twitter, Ben Shapiro writes, Ukraine is not wag the dog. It's Biden precipitating overt acts of aggression by America's enemies and then rushing to simultaneously flee and backfill the surrender. Same formula as Afghanistan. I happen to agree with Ben on that one. Our question of the day, did Oregon create a prescription drug problem for citizens by destroying pharmacies with the cat tax? I can almost guarantee you that as people say, oh, this is terrible, we don't have the pharmacies we need, and ignore the very fact that it was government that destroyed them. Government makes the problem, then government says, and we're the solution to the problem. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you
ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Les Schwab Tire Centers. Doing the right thing matters.
I want to award two Daily Grills on this Monday. Number one, restaurants, and in this case, it's restaurants in Portland, although I think that restaurants in other big Northwest cities are having the same problem. They say that lax on crime policies of law enforcement, including police, courts, DAs, the legislature, and the governors, are killing them. But then I would ask back, who'd you vote for? Bar and restaurant owners across Portland say break-ins are now rampant, frequent repair costs. Some are worried about staying afloat. They quote Nate Tilden, who owns several Portland restaurants. He says he still sees break-ins, even though his staff leaves nothing of value behind after closing. He said it's a crowbar at 3 in the morning or a brick through the window. And then they take an iPad, which they can sell for $20. What it cost us is a $5,000 door. And once again, I'd ask, did you vote? If you voted for the people making these decisions, have you decided to stand up, go to their office, and demand that they fix the problem? Until that happens, it ain't going to get fixed. Second one, I want to give a grill to Gonzaga University. I attended there for a student for a short period of time about 40 years ago. They have now suspended the season tickets for the Gonzaga Bulldogs for John Stockton. Yeah, John Stockton lost his season tickets because he wouldn't follow the university's mask mandates. I hope someday we can look back on this whole episode in America and think, how crazy were we to follow the directions of people who can't even make up their minds about masks, including Dr. Fauci. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com, is brought to you by River City Environmental, the leading environmental and emergency services company in the Northwest, now hiring with full benefits, leading pay, and a signing bonus. Online, you find them at RiverCityUSA.com/careers. Scott Pine writes in, Last week, we talked a lot about the election in which it was decided, I think, at this point, that two members of the Newburgh School Board would not be recalled for taking what some people said was an outrageous position. That is, get all the politics out of the classrooms so kids can learn. I actually thought it was perfectly common sense. But he noticed something, and he said, last week you said that on that school board recall election, we wouldn't know for at least a week and maybe longer. He says, because ballots, if postmarked up to 7 days after the day of voting, well, they have to be postmarked the day of the election, but they may come in 7 days later. It'll take up to 3 weeks to complete the final tally of votes for 20 to 25,000 votes. Can you imagine if this were a statewide election where 2 million ballots were cast? Who thinks up these insane rules? Signed, Scott. And Scott, the answer to your question is the Oregon legislature. And in Washington State, the Washington legislature. Let's go to Salem and talk to Ron, listening on the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, Ron, welcome to Monday. What's on your mind?
Oh, brother, I'm going to hit you real quick. Two things. Sure. Number one, it's Oregon Health Authority. They think they're knights and lords over us, don't they?
Yes,
they do. They don't realize the power of the people is our servants. It's called the legislature, senators, or representatives. They need to get that in their head. I think I could probably get, if I get an attorney, I think if they want to put these mandates, I would love an attorney to represent me because they're stepping on my privacy or my medical freedoms.
And yeah, they are.
The thing is, Asians and everybody else, if the score is 75 to get into Harvard or Stanford or even Oregon State, it shouldn't matter what color, which race, which economics is. And these people that go through, because we stay silent, we need to get a backbone, as I've been trying to tell the Republican Party throughout the state. And we got to go and react. Be like the mama bears of Virginia. It's time to come out of the cave, people. Bring out the claws peacefully, but get your points across and vote righteously for the right candidate that will stand on constitutional principles.
Absolutely right. And Ron, by the way, I'll welcome any of those colleges to put their administrators or their board of trustees on this program and explain why they should act like Jim Crow when they're deciding student admissions. Back in just a moment. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. First, under you ain't going to believe this, I want to give you a phrase that has popped up, and I need to get a definition of it. Although the minute I saw it, I thought, I have to talk about this. It's called a native land acknowledgement. And if you wonder, what the heck is that? Well, a professor at the University of Washington is now the subject of controversy for inserting his opinion about the native land acknowledgement that administrators at the Paul Allen School of Computer Science and Engineering said you should put one of these in each one of the syllabi that you hand out to students. Jen Cabani joins me now, who's editor with the College Fix. Jen, welcome back to the program. And can we start by just defining what is a native land acknowledgement?
So a native land acknowledgement is where professors will put on their syllabus that we acknowledge that the land that we're teaching on and operating on was previously owned by Native Americans, and we're so sorry that we're on it now and that the white man stole it from you.
Now, hold on. One of the details on this, and I don't want to get too far afield, but when people bring up Native, you know, Natives owned the land, in Native Americans, I said, did they even have the concept of land ownership? Was that a part of Native society? Because my recollection of reading everything I've read about Native Americans over decades is they didn't really hold to an idea that we own this piece of land. You had it until you decided to move somewhere else or until somebody else took it by force, and that was the set of rules among the tribes at the time, to the extent that there were any rules at all. The unspoken rule is it's yours as long as you can keep it, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It ignores the conquest paradigm that Native American tribes had at the time, where they were, you know, warring with each other and taking land over with each other or displacing each other. But the Native land acknowledgement is really only when the evil white man came. That's when the real stealing began. But prior to that, what the Native Americans were doing amongst themselves was just peaceful and peace-loving and, smoking the peace pipe, that kind of thing.
Jen Cabani is an editor of the College Fix, so I don't know if I'll murder the pronunciation of his name, but Professor Stuart Regis, is that the way you say his name?
I think so, Regis.
Regis. He wrote a syllabus for his Computer Science and Engineering 143 class, And then he decided to add a little personalization to that syllabus before he handed it out to students. He said, I acknowledge that by the labor theory of property, the Coast Salish people can claim historical ownership of almost none of the land currently occupied by the University of Washington. Apparently, he wasn't buying into the woke ideas coming from the college administration.
Yeah, essentially, he is arguing that the value of land over time is basically accrued by the people who add value to the land, who's working the land. And so that would be the people that have built up the University of Washington over the last 100 years. And, you know, if these professors and administrators were really sincere about giving Native Americans their due, that they should give the university back then if they're so worried about it.
I'm not even sure why this relates in any way to a computer science class, but what was the reaction of the students at the University of Washington, and what was the reaction of the administration to Stuart Regis's argument?
Well, administrators were swift to crack down on the syllabus. They censored it, they amended it, took out the offending statement and created a new one and created a shadow class that students could enroll in so that their feelings weren't hurt by Professor Regis. And so Regis was basically censored and told to get in line, but he refused. That's the beauty of it. This guy is a fighter. This isn't the first time he's been in the crosshairs of administrators. And he said, no, I'm not taking it off unless all the professors take their land acknowledgments off.
And who exactly was offended by what he wrote? Did anybody actually step up and say, I'm a student and I don't like what he wrote?
I think on Reddit, there was some students who were, you know, voicing anonymous concerns. But the gal who took the lead was just an administrator who, you know, emailed the class, apologized for the offensive, quote unquote, you know, land acknowledgement, and, you know, encourage them to report any concerns that they had and take advantage of the, you know, university's counseling programs.
So the university that's telling its professors, put this at the head of your syllabi so that you acknowledge that we really don't own this land. It was taken by evil white people from the true owners. Is the university planning to hand the land back or the title to the land back to any of the local tribes?
Well, you know, that's the irony. It's kind of been, these land acknowledgements have been described as the cheapest form of campus virtual signaling. You know, if they were really true, you know, give the Native Americans reparations then. Or I saw one pundit suggest let them open a casino in the middle of campus. But, you know, no, it's just, you know, it's just a cheap, easy way of virtual signaling and making them feel like, you know, they're doing something positive for the progressive movement and teaching students that the white man is bad, bad, bad.
Well, and tell me this, it's also a way of sort of filtering your faculty, because you can figure out which ones will go along and simply say, OK, fine, they told me to put this on there, I'll put it on there. And then there will be others like Professor Regis who say no to this. Did any of his colleagues stand up and say, hey, he's right, leave him alone and stop doing this virtue signaling? Did he get any support from his fellow faculty members or from the professional organizations that represent college faculty?
So he does have some support from the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education.
Fire.
But he's untenured. He already has been in trouble because a couple of years ago he wrote a piece called Why Women Don't Code. And that caused all sorts of headaches and nightmares for him because people were furious that he dared spell out gender differences between men and women and preferences and so on. So he was already on thin ice when they went to renew his contract. Some professors wanted him outright dismissed. Other professors wanted him to get another 3-year contract, which is what he was used to. And then they compromised for a 1-year extension. So the writing might be on the wall for a good Professor Regis, who's just trying to point out the idiocy and hypocrisy of his peers.
Jen,
and basically argue for you know, diversity of viewpoint, because he's basically saying, hey, look, if you just say, let me put a land acknowledgement on this, let me say what I want. Don't tell me what to write and don't censor my words. That's basic academic freedom 101.
Which I don't think is unreasonable. And Jen, you know, I've been quoting Martin Niemöller,
The guy who wrote the famous little set of lines saying, when they came to, for the socialist workers, I wasn't one, so I didn't say anything. And then when they came for the Jews, I didn't say anything because I wasn't one. And then finally, when they came for me, there was nobody left to stand up. But the last 2 years, including stuff like this, seemed to, I would think that some of those other professors would say, if I don't stand up for Professor Regis, one of these days they're going to come to me and they're going to say, you say this or else. And what am I going to say when they do that? It seems as though professors, if nobody else in American society, would have a recognition that if you don't stand up for free speech among your colleagues, they're going to come for yours next. And yet, on these stories like this, I always see these professors standing all by themselves and their colleagues saying, no, I don't want to see that. I want to keep my job.
Exactly. Yeah, 2 points. One, what's interesting is Professor Regis is openly gay. You know, so he is technically part of a marginalized group, but nobody seems to care about that because he doesn't, you know, advance the progressive narrative. Secondly, professors are so scared for their jobs. They're so scared to speak up. If they have a differing opinion, or even if they have a centrist opinion, they are quickly become pariahs on campus and, you know, labeled with all sorts of ad hominem attacks. So I think a lot of professors are just really scared right now and trying to survive, unfortunately.
No doubt. Jen Cabani is an editor at the College Fix. You can find the College Fix online. University of Washington says to an administrator, say these words or else, and everybody else caves but him. Good for Professor Regis. We'll be back in a moment. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and happy Monday from the Radio Northwest Network. If you want to join in to the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. On Friday's Twitter poll, should the IRS and government benefits programs use facial recognition to protect against fraud? 36% of you joined me in a yes vote on that. 64% of you said no. On our Twitter poll today, should the Supreme Court, which just announced it was taking up the case a few hours ago, ban American colleges from giving preference on skin color? That one should be a 100% yes, except I imagine I'll get a naysayer here and there because the Supreme Court has decided to decide on Harvard University and the University of North Carolina. Although these days it's hard to find an American college that is not using racial preference as part of the way that it evaluates students, saying, well, you have really good SAT scores. If you were white, you would not get in. But if you were brown or black, you would get in. If you're Asian, work harder. You are held to a higher standard. And the idea that colleges would hold one group to a higher standard just simply based on who your parents are, where they came from, whether or not you're Asian, black, white, brown, whatever, just seems absolutely absurd to me. But today's Twitter poll can be found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. If you don't like Twitter, go to my website. It's safe. Ultimate Truck Service is who brings you the poll every day. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. I've been making the case for a good long time that allowing homeless camps to proliferate in Northwest cities creates a clear and present danger to law-abiding citizens, not just those people who live in the camps, but the people who live nearby. And we've given you example after example over the last couple of years. Homeless camps that are set up like a gauntlet around an elementary school in Seattle, and the city says, we won't do anything about it. And the school district says, we won't do anything about it. And there it is. Your kids having to run a gauntlet past drug addicts and people who are high on drugs just to get to their elementary school. Consider this example from late last week. Our friends at Como reported it, which is the sister station to our Seattle affiliate, KVI. A man was injured by a crossbow bolt on Thursday afternoon in Seattle's Capitol Hill neighborhood. The incident happened at a homeless encampment, and it happened right in the middle of the afternoon, 12:30 in the afternoon. The police said the victim was involved in an altercation with another man who shot the victim with a crossbow and then fled the scene. Police arrived, and they found a 30-year-old man with a crossbow bolt sticking out of his chest. The victim was treated at the scene, triaged off to the hospital. He's in critical condition. Officers are collecting evidence. Now, if you say, well, that happened to somebody who lived in the camp. I don't know if the man who was wounded by this crossbow bolt lives in that camp or not. He may have been somebody who lives in the nearby neighborhood. This is the kind of risk you're looking at. Fires, needles, drug use, drug dealing, and use of weapons like prehistoric weapons like crossbows. Let's go to Alice. Hey, Alice, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Just wanted to let you know, I'm sorry, I just had some dental work done, but I wanted to let you know I'm in line now to get my COVID test, and I was told by my doctor there is antiviral med, but only available to those that are hospitalized.
Really? So you can't, and which one, the monoclonal antibodies, or is it one of the others, the new antivirals that the pharma companies are going to make a lot of money on?
I asked them, is there any antiviral med? And they said, no, not unless you get bad enough to be hospitalized.
So in other words, they're going to wait potentially till you're very sick before they give it to you. I guess at some level, Alice, I could see it, since we know that the vast majority of people, especially with Omicron, are not going to get terribly sick. And if they have a limited supply of a drug, I could imagine reserving it for those who are especially ill. Because if they gave it to everybody with Omicron, an awful lot of people have Omicron, it's like the regular flu. You get sick for a few days, you go home, you drink a lot of water, you take some Tylenol to fight the fever, you sleep a lot, and you're up and around. Two members of my staff went through exactly that situation, and one of them is particularly high risk because of his prior bout with cancer and other issues. So is it necessarily wrong to say we should reserve those for the most critically ill?
Oh, I don't think it's wrong. I sure wouldn't want to bump somebody out of that, but I just am shocked to know that in our country today, where we have a lot of money to develop meds, that we have a shortage of the antiviral meds that we need today.
And that's a very good point. Alice, thank you very much. And we're way too dependent on China for a lot of the precursors that go into those meds. Let's go to Craig. Hey, Craig, welcome to the Lars Larson Show on a Monday. What's on your mind?
Thanks, Lars. The other day, someone dumped a mattress and stuff at the corner. So I called up the city nuisance, and in the message it says, we'll pick up anything on public property and on sidewalks, except for anything to do with homeless camps.
What? They won't pick up when it has to do with homeless camps?
Yep.
Well, I guess that gives you the solution. I mean, I wouldn't do it myself. But what are they going to do when average folks get so up to here that they've decided their civil disobedience will be to take the household trash for a week and go down and dump it at the homeless camp? Because,
I don't doubt people aren't doing that now.
And when they do that, will it send the message that when you create a different set of rules for people who live on public property and in ways that are clearly antisocial, there's only one way to fight back, and it may be civil disobedience. Craig, thanks for the call. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the past 22 years, and bringing honestly provocative talk, sometimes so honest that we actually provoke the naysayers to call in and afford us a liberal point of view. I want to talk about something involving the primary election in May in the state of Oregon. Washington State has a whole different set of rules, but I frequently get calls from people who say, why can't I vote in the Republican primary if I'm not a Republican? And the answer I always give is, if you're not a member of the Republican Party, why would the Republicans want you to help them choose the nominees that will run under the Republican Party banner? It's one of the little strange things about American politics, but frankly, I don't find it that strange. If you decide that you want to run somebody as a Democrat candidate representing the Democrat Party for governor or for senator or any of the other positions, I don't find it that strange to say, and we want Democrats to choose the Democrat candidates, Republicans choose the Republicans. Oregon State Senator Dallas Hurd, who's from Roseburg and also chair of the Oregon GOP, joins me now. You said that you have a plan for making some changes to allow non-affiliated voters to vote in the primary. Welcome back to the program, and tell me about this plan that leaked out.
Yeah, thanks, Lars. So the issue we're focused on is taking up the debate on whether the party delegates, which, just for folks listening, the delegates are elected by precinct committee persons who are registered Republican volunteers who are elected every 2 years by registered Republican voters. And so it's this whole long deal about how we get to a party delegate. But a party delegate is the people that elects me to be chairman. And they also take up votes and discussions like whether non-affiliated voters should be allowed to opt in to our primary this election to be able to vote for who the Republican nominees for all positions will be going forward. And so we'll be taking up the debate on February 5th in the Salem region to discuss the matter. But the proposal I'm bringing forward is just simply a suitcase full of facts, statutes, polling and whatnot, explaining to the delegates who non-affiliated voters are, how many of them there are, and also other states that have done something similar on the Republican side of things, and how it has contributed to states like West Virginia going from only one out of 34 Senate seats being Republican to supermajorities, the House, the Senate, statewide office, and so on and so forth.
Okay, so just so I understand, this only concerns delegates to the Oregon GOP. It doesn't yet say that non-affiliated voters would have a vote in the primary on the actual candidates who are running. Am I right?
That is correct, sir.
Okay, so when we have three or four people running for the Republican nomination for governor, that decision will still be made by members of the party, but decisions on delegates could be made by non-affiliated voters. I haven't seen the numbers recently, but the last time I checked, it seemed non-affiliated voters, that is, people who are not registered as a Republican or as a Democrat, they actually may outnumber members of the actual parties, do they?
Yeah, so to bring clarity to that for the folks listening, independent registered voters are an actual party, so they're not non-affiliated. Libertarian, Constitution, Working Families, those are all actual parties, although they may be considered minor parties, whereas Republican and Democrat are considered major. Non-affiliated means, it literally says on your registration for the state of Oregon, no political party affiliation of any kind. And they're right at 998,000 strong, whereas the Democrats are just over a million. So, there is actually more non-Republican, non-Democrats. But if we're specifically looking at just the kind of registered folks that the Republican delegates are debating over whether to allow into our primary, they're about a million strong. So they're a massive voting block of people. And to me, I just feel like as a servant of the people, my job is to know the truth, stand up for principle and honesty and God-fearing values, and then go out and explain to my neighbor who is not yet thinking or just like me, but may believe a lot of the same things, persuade them to come with me so that we can reverse the fortunes of this state and stop allowing universal control by people like Kate Brown.
Yeah, and I'm all for that, because I think the state, having had a Democrat governors for the past one-third of a century, we can see the kind of devastation that it's caused the state. Employment is poor, the economy is poor, average wages are poor, and actually the functioning of the state seems poor because one-party control just never really leads to a good result. And I'd even apply that if it was one-party control with the Republicans in control.
I agree.
So, but this changes just the delegate rules. Could you see the day where we would allow non-members of the Republican Party to decide who the nominees are to run for governor, senator, et cetera?
So this is not taking up the conversation around whether non-Republicans can run for Republican positions in the primary.
Right.
This is strictly about who voters are being allowed to vote. So if I was a non-affiliated registered individual, I could not just say, well, I'm going to run for the Republican ticket, even though I'm not going to be a Republican. In fact, the deadline to be a Republican and thus run for a Republican candidacy for this primary has already passed. You have to have made that party change 6 months prior to the election day of the May primary for a candidate. This is strictly focused on the voters. So those a million voters that I talked about, that's all we're focused on, is whether they're going to have the option to go to their county clerk's office, get paperwork similar to voter registration, and say, I want to opt into the Republican primary as a voter and have the opportunity to vote for who the Republican candidate for governor is going to be, state senator, state representative, dog catcher, whatever. It's just about the voters.
Okay, so who has to say yes to this? The GOP delegate?
That's correct. So there's roughly just over 130 delegates selected by the voters through the Republican voters through the process that I outlined earlier. They come together when we have situations like this to take up. we will debate the situation. We will bring up all the facts, the polling that we have, folks from like West Virginia who have seen the benefits of extending the olive branch to non-affiliated voters like this. And then someone will then move forward and us going into, and that'd be my job, will move forward into the voting round of it. And then at that point, it is simply a majority vote plus one on whether the party's rules to allow this to take place will or will not happen.
And they could be changed quickly enough to affect the May primary?
Yeah, so state statute dictates that we must have the paperwork, if a change like this was made, submitted in to the Secretary of State's office by February 16th of this year for the May primary to be affected.
All right, so you've got a short timeline. Do you mind sticking around for a moment, Senator? Because I want to ask you about a change that was made to the way that ballots are counted. And this one is far less technical than what you and I just went over, but it has an effect on how ballots are counted and vote by mail, because that changed just recently. We saw the first example of it in the Newberg recall vote, and it didn't exactly have a good result, at least not from my point of view. And I had a question posed by a listener who wanted to know, what's this going to do to the other elections? Do you mind sticking around for a few?
It'd be my pleasure.
Very good. Oregon State Senator Dallas Hurd, he represents District 1, which is Roseburg and the surrounding area. He's also chair of the Oregon GOP. We'll be back to talk about that in just a moment. We'll get to your phone calls and emails after that at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. This is the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network on a Monday. 23 radio stations around the Pacific Northwest that serve this region, bringing you honestly provocative talk on a daily basis and allowing naysayers to call into the show if they like. I've got Dallas Hurd with me, a state senator from District 1 and also the chair of the Oregon GOP. I wanted to ask you about an election voting ballot counting issue in a moment that I think is pretty concerning. But before I do that, you and I were talking about non-affiliated voters and whether or not they'll have a role in the Republican primary coming up in May if you get the rules rewritten and then submitted by, I think, the 16th of February. Do we have any? You said there are almost a million of these non-affiliated voters. They're not libertarians. They're not one of the other smaller parties. They're not Democrats. They're not Republicans. But a million people who've chose to affiliate with nobody. What do we know about them as far as what their beliefs and values are?
That's a great question, Lars. So, you know, as the chair of the party, I consider myself to be, you know, the older brother for everyone. And so I take a lot of responsibility on, and I really hold myself accountable in that. And my mission is to make sure that I promote the values of the Republican Party and Constitution, God-fearing, and so on and so forth. And when we are looking at the possibility of opening the door up to allow folks like this to opt in that are currently not fully committed to being Republicans, I want to know who they are before I even called this meeting. So I had a poll commissioned of about 1,150 people across different parts of the state. It's more the equivalent of about a 4,000-person statewide poll, which is massive of a sample. It gives you a really high-definition look at who people are. And so what's really been encouraging to me was that nearly 80% of these folks were strongly in favor of school choice. And for the folks listening, that's saying that we want parents to be able to make the decision on where their tax dollars go based on where their children are going to school. Private or public is what we asked. And so we want to break up the monopoly of the public school system and the teachers union and so on and so forth. So these folks are massively conservative on that idea. Nearly two-thirds of them said that if the Republican Party showed them this level of respect to allow them to opt into our primary and actually vote for who the Republican nominees for any position you can think of across the state would be this November, that they are significantly more likely to vote for those Republicans in the general election. And there were several other issues, like their number one most important issue was economy, jobs. Their number two issue was public safety, policing. And their number three issue, Lars, was lowering taxes. And
right.
I know you and I know the same, but I don't know what more contrast we could provide for issues than those top three, and we nail it.
Well, and, you know, I often have people call in and say, all you care about is taxes. No, I care about, you know, in terms of government, I want the government that we have to have. Because there are certain functions in a society like ours that can only really be done by a government agency. Running the Pentagon would be a good example. Running the courts, I would not suggest that we farm out the court system to private industry. But an awful lot of government could be done by private sector, you know, folks. And so we could have a much smaller government, but still get all of the services we want from government. But many of the people who work in government, both at the local and state level and at the federal level, seem to think that government is the be-all and end-all solution to everything. And when I look at the way they do their job, and I look at the way government agencies run and either perform or don't perform, I'm frequently disappointed by how they do their job. So let me ask you about this ballot issue, though. Because I thought one of my listeners had a great insight. You heard about the attempted recall of two members of the Newburgh School Board that was voted on last week, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and it appears those two have survived the recall, and I think they should have. All they asked was get the politics out of the classroom. But the person who wrote to me this morning said, hey, I think the total number of registered voters in that community is about 25,000. It might be a little bit higher than that. And they had about 50% turnout. It's pretty good. A good number of turnout for a non-primary election, non-general election. And they said, but because of the new rules that went into effect January 1, that say you can vote, and if your ballot is postmarked by Election Day, so last Tuesday, you have to wait at least 7 days for all of those ballots to come in. So tomorrow is when they can really get a final count. Now, that may not always make a difference. There may be elections where the difference between two candidates is large enough that if you've got a few hundred or a few thousand ballots outstanding, they're not likely to change the result. But he posed the question, if it's going to delay a tiny vote of a few thousand, counting a few thousand ballots, what's it going to do to things like the primary election in May and the general election in November when you have to wait until at least seven days after the date of the election, and then you can start counting, especially if we're talking not about hundreds of votes, but maybe thousands, tens of thousands, or even hundreds of thousands of ballots. They're all counted at the last minute. Do you have any insight as to what that's going to do to this year's election?
Well, only God knows what the actual total outcome is going to be in the end. But what I've found, Lars, throughout my time of public service, is that wickedness preys upon destabilization, uncertainty, lessening of standards. And so regardless of whatever the hearts are of the people that put forward these kinds of laws, the facts remain. Reality commands us to admit that wickedness preys on these types of actions. And so it's very concerning that we continue at every turn in liberal-controlled states. And right now the country is under hard leftist control. I almost think, frankly, liberal in the traditional sense is not a good way of describing it, because this is not traditional liberalism anymore. This is radical leftism.
And I'd agree. But the concern I've got is that every time we widen this from election day to now, the ballots go out 3 weeks ahead of time. They come in,
yes,
and then they sit there from election day to at least 7, possibly 10, maybe even 10 days, maybe even 2 or 3 weeks after it. You've got a period of time that may be as long as 6 weeks in there. And every time you have that kind of window, I see the opportunities for fraud and for people to mess with the outcome of the election, saying, oh, gee, we just found another box full of ballots. Like, both Washington and Oregon have had experience with the last-minute ballot boxes. So has Minnesota. So has California. And I'm worried about this as they broaden the window bigger and bigger and bigger. We don't have an election day anymore. We sort of have an election season. It's bigger than a month these days. And it seems to afford all kinds of opportunity for cheating.
If accuracy is the goal, if honesty is the goal, if correct outcomes is the goal, loosening standards is the opposite direction we should be going. The more we loosen standards, the more those who do not have good character, do not fear God, do not have principle guiding them, but frankly just want natural law of the dominant thrive, the dominant win, it's actually playing into their hands. And I think we're going to see worse and worse outcomes for the poor, the weak, the few in this country, the more we allow standards to be loosened. We need to return to a time of standards, reasonable, but still firm, consistent standards that take us to a place of stability and consistency. And that's what's going to give us back the lives we've lost of prosperity and neighbors actually being able to love each other and having confidence in our government and our elections. The more we broaden these things, the looser it gets, the more distrust thrives and we get to where we're at right now. And I just think we need to step back from these kinds of rules and laws, because like you're saying, I agree with what you're saying. It's just ripe for causing problems. But
no doubt. That is Senator Dallas Hurd from the Roseburg area. Coming up in a moment, you heard today 8,500 U.S. troops put on standby because of Russia and Ukraine. We'll talk about what might happen in that kind of contest coming up next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. As you may have heard just a few hours ago, the Pentagon put up to 8,500 U.S. service members on high alert as the Ukraine crisis gets worse. And then Jen Psaki, the president's spokeswoman, who occasionally forgets and says she works for President Obama, which I think might be literally true, she came out and was answering questions about what they plan to do with these troops. Are they going to go to Ukraine? No. Are they going to go anywhere? No. But they're designed to intimidate Russia out of invading Ukraine with the promise that the troops won't go to Ukraine. Now, if that makes sense to you, then you should explain it to me. I thought we'd get Lieutenant Colonel James Carafano on because he's an expert in national security and foreign policy challenges, now with the Heritage Foundation. Colonel, welcome back to the program.
I'm sorry, my jaw just dropped so far down. I can't even lift it up to say hi.
What? Which part was it? The Jen Psaki part, the 8,500 service members on high alert, or the fact that we're putting them on alert with the promise that they won't go anywhere near Ukraine?
Anywhere. Yeah, okay, that makes no sense whatsoever. Actually, rather than deter Putin, that is a green light to invade. If somebody said we're going to send 8,500 troops to NATO, to Europe, I would say, okay, that would make sense. And here's how. We're not going to fight. This isn't between like us fighting war with Ukraine. That's not. Ukraine's going to fight for Ukraine. I mean, it's 44 right. million Ukrainians. They're going to fight, and they're going to fight hard. It's their fight. They're not a NATO out. Everybody gets that, right? So this isn't about like us going over war with Ukraine, because we're just not going to do that. What we are going to do is we're going to contribute to Ukraine's self-defense. Now, that supply line that supplies arms and ammunition, medical assistance, everything into Ukraine, every inch of that up to the Ukrainian border is in NATO territory.
Right.
And if there is a shooting war, Putin should have no belief whatsoever that he could cross one inch into NATO territory and try to interdict that supply line.
Right.
And putting those troops there to protect and safeguard that supply line, that makes perfect sense. It makes perfect sense to do this now as a deterrent. If there's any other thing, is just sounds like another stupid thing from these guys.
Well, they may be, they're saying, for potential deployment to Eastern Europe, but to NATO, as you said, rather than to Ukraine specifically. But is this going to actually deter Putin from doing anything?
No. See, this is none of this, you know. Threats, everything after the fact doesn't deter Putin. I mean, if he is willing to risk a war against 44 million people to seize territory and bomb them and kill them and create millions of refugees, this notion that we're going to do something after that that's going to annoy him is nonsense. Well, if we're serious about deterring him, we should be doing things up front to deter him, not after the fact. Look, Blinken the other day said, well, the administration went in, but their whole thing was about we want to de-escalate, which is nonsense because the Russians escalated. We're not like negotiating between, you know, warring parents here. And the diplomacy has no role here. And even Blinken said the other day, well, maybe the Russians are just buying for time. Well, dude, you just acknowledge that this is all nonsense. The only thing Russia respects is stuff that we do, not stuff that we say. And so right. This is just... To do this is actually worse than do nothing, because it just shows that you're feckless and afraid to act.
And yet, is the real purpose of this for Joe Biden? I mean, we frequently accuse Putin of saying he's doing this to distract his country from its own domestic problems. You know, well, we should look in the mirror occasionally. Is it possible, do you think, that Joe Biden is doing some of this because he screwed the border, he screwed the withdrawal from Afghanistan, he screwed inflation, he screwed energy supply and price and everything else. He's got a screwed up country, and a lot of the screwing was done by Joe Biden. And he'd like to distract America from that by saying, hey, war with Albania, right? And I threw that in for a wag the dog reference.
Can I do something without doing anything?
Yeah.
And I said, oh, look, I'm deterring the Russians. I ordered 8,500 troops to get ready. But they're not actually doing anything. Look, the one thing we should be really clear about, and I think this is an important point that can't get lost. The reason why we are where we are is because of Joe Biden. This would not be happening if Joe Biden wasn't president. It 4 years, it never happened under Trump, and there's a reason for that. Well, Biden came into office, and he put in for a defense budget that didn't even cover the cost of inflation. The Russians saw that as weakness. He ran away from Afghanistan and then spent more time, like Obama, trying in Benghazi, trying to avoid responsibility than deal with the crisis. Weakness. Then he comes in and tries to negotiate with Putin. Weakness. The Russians see weakness in Biden, and they're acting that. This crisis, and this isn't a political comment, it's a partisan comment, there would be no crisis today if Joe Biden wasn't president of the United States.
Yep.
Fact.
I'll tell you what, Colonel, I'll give full credit. J.D. Vance is a writer, but he's also running for office. But he posted today, and I thought, well, every time I see a post that resonates with me, I want to repeat it. He says, call me crazy, but if Trump ordered ground troops to, and at least heightened alert for ground troops to protect a country that had paid his family millions of dollars in illegal cash, I'll bet the media would be covering it differently. Well, is that a valid point that Joe Biden has ties to Ukraine? Go ahead, sir.
No, absolutely. It's a valid point. I mean, this president's gotten a pass. This is my number one message to America. If you've learned nothing else from this, because, you know, when we had this election in 2020, people were like, well, I'm voting. I don't like the tweets. Or I'm voting on health care, whatever. And I'm like, no, dude, you're voting for the commander in chief, whether you want to think it or not. We have to stop treating American politics like a buffet table. Like, I'll take a slice of pro-life and a few, you know, low taxes, but I don't care about anything else. All this stuff affects our lives, and we have to take it seriously. The guy ran for president from the basement, faced no hard questions, was obviously incompetent, and people voted for him anyway. And that's why we got the crisis that we got. People need to pay attention. The media is not going to hold him accountable. The pundits are not going to hold him accountable. Washington is not going to hold him. The only thing that holds these people accountable is the American people themselves. And if we don't educate ourselves on these issues and be serious about these issues, you know, we're going to get what we deserve. And I tell people, you know, it's like nobody wants to do homework. But if you remember, after you did your homework, you were smarter, you were more self-confident, you got a better job, you were more successful. It's worth doing our homework on these issues and thinking for ourselves on this, because otherwise we're going to get more of what we got here. Right? And here we are really at the most incompetent president creating the most serious global crisis since the Berlin airlift. And Americans have to wake up and look and think about this, because the media is not going to do that. And certainly Washington is not going to hold him accountable for this.
Colonel, in the last couple of seconds, one of the first things Biden did, and I thought it was stupid, was approving Nord Stream 2, saying we'll take off the sanctions, go ahead and build your pipeline. If he were to say to Putin, continue the actions you're doing in Ukraine now, and we're gonna reimpose the sanctions, would that be something he could do that Putin would actually pay attention to?
Shut down Nord Stream 2. We should just say we're going to sanction the hell out of anybody that goes near that pipeline. We shouldn't threaten any. We should just do it, because that's what Putin respects. If you're going to defend NATO supply lines, defend them. If you're going to take away Nord Stream 2, do it. There was a very famous incident happened in Syria. Some Russian mercenaries attacked the U.S. Trump bombed the hell out of them, and the Russians took away from that. Let's leave the Americans alone. Act. Don't threaten. Threaten me nothing to a bully like Putin.
Absolutely. Lieutenant Colonel James Carafano, who's at the Heritage Foundation, an expert in national security and foreign policy challenges. Colonel, it is always my pleasure to have you on for exactly what you just said. 866 Hey Lars, you're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network. It's a pleasure to be with you, and if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, you're certainly welcome. Haven't had a naysayer yet today, but we always put naysayers to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com. And this segment of the show is brought to you by NickShivers.com. Go to NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showing, no hassles, and you pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for all the details. Now, our Twitter poll, should the Supreme Court ban American colleges from giving preference based on skin color? And if you said, well, Lars, you can't do that, can you? That's against federal law. It's against the Constitution. It's against most state laws. It's against everything you could think of. Well, a lot of colleges already do this. They say, if you're applying to our college, and you have really great SAT scores, they'll get you in. Oh, I'm sorry. Turns out you're Asian. You're going to need even better test scores. Oh, but if you're black or brown, if you're Hispanic or black, then those test scores will easily get you into our college. That is the way the system works today. And if you think it's only at Harvard and the University of North Carolina, it's not. Other colleges do the same thing, including colleges here in the Pacific Northwest. So the Supreme Court announced a few hours ago it will take up the case challenging Harvard and the University of North Carolina on their race-based admissions process. It could bring about, and this is the way the mainstream media reports, it could bring about the end of affirmative action. Well, if affirmative action means this set of test scores gets you in if you're black, does not get you in if you're white, and especially does not get you in if you're Asian. If that's the way that affirmative action works, I would love to hear the naysayer who says that is a legitimate way to decide the futures of young men and young women who apply to college. I mean, we know that the vast majority of people in this country do not need to go to college. The number needed by the economy is somewhere between 25 and 30%, which means the other 70% may need some technical training, but college doesn't matter. But what does matter is when a college says we're going to have different standards for different kids based on their skin color, I want somebody, a naysayer, to tell me why they think a system like that is in any way legitimate. Today's Twitter poll can be found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. The vote counts the same no matter which way you go. I don't particularly like Twitter. We're going to get away from it as fast as we can. And by the way, we are on Getter, at Lars Larson. Just that, at Lars Larson. Didn't have to do the at Lars Larson Show like we did with Twitter. But the Twitter poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. I want to point something out that is also just developed today, and it has to do with New York City. And you say, well, what relevance does that have to the Pacific Northwest? If you haven't noticed, both the biggest cities in the Northwest, Portland and Seattle, and a lot of other mid-sized cities, because of the mobs in the streets over the last 2 years, have said, okay, we will defund the police. We will dramatically diminish the number of cops on the streets. And what's happened as a result? More people have died as a result of murder. More people have been hurt as a result of violent crime. And a lot of us have said, look, this is insanity to say we're a big city, but we are not going to provide enough police to actually enforce the law. And then to compound that, you had the governors of the two states in particular, Kate Brown and Jay Inslee of Oregon and of Washington, saying, we're going to cut convicted criminals loose from prison. So we're going to send a message to the criminal class, go ahead, commit more crimes. We're not going to do anything about it. And if that wasn't bad enough, you then have district attorneys in Oregon and prosecutors in Washington state, not all of them, but a significant number of them, who said, by the way, in the interest of justice, again, based on race-related reasons, we're simply not going to prosecute certain crimes. Well, I hope you heard over the weekend, terrible incident happened. Two cops, including a rookie in New York City, went to address a domestic violence call. A woman had called. She said, I can't control my adult son. Can you please come and help? And they're walking down this narrow hallway. and her son, 47 years old, criminal rap sheet as long as your arm, pops out of the door at the end of this long, you know, narrow, dead-end hallway and starts shooting. And he's working off a 45 or 50-round magazine with a Glock. He kills one of the cops at the scene, critically injures the other one. Well, the police have now settled his score. He's dead. They have now killed him. They found him and they killed him, which I think is perfectly appropriate under the situation. But Mayor Eric Adams, a former cop himself who was elected as mayor of New York City, has now unveiled his strategy to combat rising gun violence. He's bringing back the Gun Violence Reduction Team, their gun unit. Now, that was one of the units that was targeted in places like Portland and Seattle, where the politically correct politicians who run the cities said, well, gee, we're going to give up those things. Because when they arrest people in the anti-gun unit, which used to be a gang unit in Portland's case, they catch too many people of color. Mayor Eric Adams, who is himself black, is going to resurrect the NYPD anti-gun unit, especially because of this shooting spike. My question is, when is Jenny Durkin of Seattle going to do the same? When is Ted Wheeler of Portland going to do the same? Start putting the cops back out and stop the murders. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. Now, I want to talk about what is called restorative justice. And if you've been fortunate enough in your life not to run into that term, consider yourself lucky, because it is one of the most cockamamie ideas I've ever heard of. And most people, when you start describing it to them, they say, hold on. You want to have restorative justice by having the victims of crimes meet with the people who actually did the crimes? Is that part of the idea? Yeah, that is part of the idea, depending on the program. Well, King County has a youth diversion program that tries to steer teenagers away from crime. I'm not against that idea, but it's how you get it done that could be asking for a lot of trouble. And I thought we'd talk to Reagan Dunn about that, member of the King County Council and running for Washington's 8th Congressional District. Mr. Dunn, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Am I off basis, Reagan, in describing this as a crazy idea? I mean, steering kids away from trouble, yeah, I'm all for that. But how does King County propose to do it?
Well, it's, you know, most counties across the country have a diversion program, and generally, those are a good idea. And the plain vanilla example of that is, you know, some kid for the first time, and maybe gets caught shoplifting at 15 years old, and they trip you through diversion and gives you a chance maybe to do some community service, and you get that first little brush with the law maybe cleaned up and expunged. But what King County is trying to do is it's perverting the historical diversion program through this program called Restorative Justice Community Pathways. And what it does is it basically says no matter what you do, pretty much any crime that happens, for example, bringing a gun to school and brandishing that firearm, or one of these group gang retail thefts or residential burglary, breaking into somebody's house, all that stuff is going to go through diversion. You're not going to pay any consequences at all for your crimes, and you'll go out to these nonprofit groups, and you won't be held accountable at all.
Doesn't that send the message to the budding new criminal and even to the existing criminals with a long track record? We're going to let you do all this stuff, and all we're going to do is make noise about it.
Well, that's exactly what it sends, the message that you're not even going to get a slap on the wrist. You're going to get a hug, and we're going to send you away feeling better than when you committed the crime to begin with. Look, I'm a former federal prosecutor. I authored President Bush's national effort to fight gun violence, a program called Project Safe Neighborhoods. That program focuses on aggressive enforcement of those criminals committing violent crimes. The way to handle an exploding crime problem like we're seeing the top of a 50-year crime wave right now in Washington State is to hold people accountable. Sure, for very junior offenses, yeah, we can have flexibility. But for serious crimes, gang-related crimes, other things, we must have judges look at these cases, and individuals must be sentenced according to the law.
Well, the other thing I find about this, and I don't know if you feel the same way, But when we have this massive set of infrastructure, not bridges and highways, but we have judges, we have courts, we have prosecutors, we have got federal prosecutors, we've got city prosecutors in the case of Seattle, and you say we're going to take that whole infrastructure, and for these kids, the ones who may be on a path toward crime, we're going to turn it over to community groups who are not elected by the people. They're really not terribly answerable to the people. A judge, at least, could be tossed out, could be impeached, could be investigated, could be thrown out at the next election. But community groups are going to do this. And what do we do with the gigantic infrastructure we built over decades to take care of criminals? And we're just going to say, no, no, you aren't doing that kind of thing anymore. We're going to give your job off to a bunch of unnamed, faceless individuals who are not chosen by the voters?
That's exactly right. And it's a little bit of the sort of camel getting his nose under the tent, because it starts there, and then pretty soon you've got adult violent felonies going through these programs. You know, you want to have criminals see the inside of a courtroom. Society needs those criminals to face a judge, to look at what the sentencing guidelines are under the statute. If you don't have that, if you have this systematic decriminalization, which is what we've seen in Portland, in Seattle, and communities around, you get more of it. And in this case, we have seen the number of homicides double in Washington State since 2017. We're at the top of a 50-year crime wave. Clearly, what the woke left is doing isn't working, and it's actually making things much less safe for people. So, yeah, we want to push a program. Sure, we support diversion, but we do not support this form of diversion. Restorative community pathways is a very bad idea for our community.
Reagan, so people can know about your run for Congress, what's the website or the social media where they can learn more about your positions on all the issues?
Sure. Go to ReaganDunn.com. Got a new poll leading the Democrat head-to-head by 4 points. And really enjoying the run. A lot of people interested this year in flipping control of Congress and bringing some common sense back to D.C.
Let me ask you about Jimmy Hung. This is the chief of the Juvenile Division for King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office. He makes a couple of statements. One that caught my eye: the more we prosecute kids in the juvenile system, the more we lock them up, the worse they become. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't. And that should not be a statement coming from the prosecuting attorney's office. I really don't like the direction that the King County Prosecutor's Office has gone in recent years. Young people need some form of accountability. And yes, some get caught in the system and they go worse and worse. But if you're going to get in trouble, you need to be held accountable. And many of those young people will find their way out of the brush with the system because there is accountability. And that's, you know, the theory of prosecution is deterrence, right? That is why we do it. And I think Jimmy's making a big mistake. And we might as well call the King County Prosecutor's Office the second office of public defense, because they're acting like it right now.
Well, and let me ask you about the second thing he said. We need to take a holistic approach. That immediately puts my back up, to get to the underlying cause of why teenagers commit crimes. And I'm sure that all the social welfare folks or the MSWs out there can say, well, if only this kid had grown up, boy or girl, with a loving mom and dad, grown up in a, if not affluent family, at least one that was self-sufficient financially. If only, you know, they had this, that. Well, it doesn't matter if only, because you've got the kid right now. What do you want to do with him right now? And if you say, well, if we just fix their economic circumstances 10 or 20 years from now, all the kids who are growing up a couple of decades from now will be much, much better. Maybe. And maybe they won't be, because I've seen kids from affluent families get into trouble and go out and involve themselves in armed robbery and drug dealing and things like that. It ain't always about money. It ain't always about that. It's sometimes about, hey, it's a thrill.
Yeah, and there needs to be consequence for actions. See, I look at the actions. I certainly understand that various backgrounds create lots of problems, and we all need to be sensitive to that. But by the time you've gotten to school and you're brandishing a firearm, or you break into somebody's house and create a very dangerous circumstance where you or somebody else can get shot, you're past the point of having that discussion. At that point, you need to talk to a judge. You need to have the full justice system look at you and make a decision. It doesn't mean we take away the judicial discretion. Judges can say, hey, you know what, this is the first time, the circumstances seem a little dicey, I'm going to go ahead and give you a small fine and community service or restitution. Yep. Judges can still do that. What we don't want to do is say everybody's been disenfranchised and therefore the law doesn't apply to you.
Exactly right. That's Reagan Dunn running for Congress now. And I'd love to talk to the naysayers on this one. Back in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on this Monday. Always glad to be with you in the Radio Northwest Network. We've got 23 stations around Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and we try to supply honestly provocative talk radio on a daily basis. Glad to be with you. If you want to vote in our Twitter poll, the question is put up brand new every day from the news of the day. Today's question is based on the announcement this morning that the U.S. Supreme Court will take up what should be a common sense decision. Can a college tell students who'd like to go to school at that college, you can come in if you have a certain SAT score? Oh, if you have a black or brown skin, you don't need as high a SAT score. If you have white skin, higher. And if you have Asian background in your family, then you have to have an even higher set of standards to meet. And if you say, well, Lars, that's judging the kids based on their skin color. Exactly right. It is something that Jim Crow Joe Biden would probably love because he's been a practicing racist most of his political career. But the idea that colleges would say it depends on how smart your kid is, but it also depends on what color their skin is. And I cannot imagine a family member, a father, a mother, a grandfather, or a grandmother saying, I want my child judged based not on what he or she can do, or what their grades are, or what their SAT test is. I want them judged based on their skin color. Should the Supreme Court ban American colleges from giving preference based on skin color? I'd say yes to that. You can vote any way you like at Lars Larson Show or at LarsLarson.com. And always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Let's go to Gene in Kennewick listening on the great KONA. Hey, Gene, thanks for listening on the network. What's on your mind today?
Hey, longtime listener. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm reading in the local Tri-City Herald in Kennewick the wind farms that they're proposing to put in on the east side of the state. Why don't they do that on the west side of the state? I know we have a great wind tunnel here, but we have hydroelectric power, a nuclear power plant that supplies power on the west side as well as down the west coast.
Yeah.
But I'm finding it really difficult to see all these wind farms coming into eastern Washington and destroying our views when they could be put on an island over in the coast, a beach on the coast that has wind to supply their own power.
That's a reasonable objection, Gene. I mean, I don't much like NIMBY things where people say, well, I don't like the fact that our garbage gets dumped at a regional landfill near Mount Adams or in Oregon, a regional landfill that's east of the state. But I imagine the answer is in what you're asking. Why do you suppose they're buying the land in eastern Washington for wind farms instead of buying land on the west side of the state? And the answer is probably money, because wind energy and solar are both already obscenely expensive. You know, coal and nuclear and others are much more attractive economically. So the idea of buying expensive land on the west side of the state instead of inexpensive land to put them on the east side. The other thing is that at least on the east side of the state, if you've got a big a farm, I mean, Tina and I have driven all over northeastern Washington state, and we love it. Same thing for eastern Oregon. But if you drive out there and you drive past miles of wheat fields, or miles of potato fields, if you put windmills up on the side of one of those fields and the farmer makes more money from it, it doesn't do much for the view. I'm not happy with that part of it either. But do you imagine that the reason they're doing that is they can go to the farmer and say, we'd like to build 10 windmills on the side of your wheat field or your potato field, and we'll pay you for the privilege of occupying your land. The farmer is happy. The wind farm company is happy. And it makes it makes land on the west side of the state, look cheap by comparison. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We see it now between Tri-Cities and Walla Walla and Tri-Cities in Lewiston, Idaho. There's just tons of wind farm there.
Yep.
And I guess the thing is that if they want the power, why don't they put it on their side of the state?
And the answer is money, because it's money. Too expensive. Just like if you said to somebody, gee, you've got an automobile wrecking yard and the city has grown up around your location. I mean, I know plenty of you pull it yards that were once on the edge of town and they're now inside of town. And when you hear that one of those men or women who owns one of those wrecking yards has said, I'm going to sell my land that my yard is on and I'm going to move it somewhere else, the answer is why? Because when he bought the land, it was inexpensive. The city has grown up around him. It's now favorable development land for building houses or retail or whatever. And now he can buy less expensive land somewhere else. So it's because of cost. And Gene, I don't think you're ever going to see that changed, because the folks who I'm not the biggest fan of wind energy nor of solar energy. There are inherent problems in it that I think make it not make sense right now. But if you said we're going to have a law that says for every windmill you build east of the Cascade Mountains, you have to build one west of the Cascade Mountains, that would effectively kill the windmills and kill the solar panels. And right now, Gene, if you take the temperature of Olympia and Salem and ask, is the legislature in a mood to outlaw wind and solar? And the answer is no, they're not. So no. you're not gonna have much luck, are you?
I totally agree with you. Anyway, there's a House bill coming up, 1871, with Rep. Mark Clicker, and it was a nice article in our paper. And, I mean, they're talking 112 square miles of clean energy production sites. I'm a true believer of let the farmer do with his land what he chooses to do with his land.
So am I.
You know, my God, I just can't find it in my history, I guess, of living here in the Tri-Cities, of having to look out my front window on the hill and see 50 windmills cranking out power for the other side of the state when we're producing plenty of power for the other side of the state with our hydro dams and our nuclear energy.
Well, just to understand, Gene, I'm like you. I'm very much in favor of private property rights as well. And I really resist the notion of saying, I don't like that there because I don't like the look of it. And then you have to consider there are probably people who would say about your house or somebody else's house, gee, that land was a lot prettier when it was a big farm field or when it was a forest than it is now with a bunch of houses built on it. And by that logic, if we said we want to preserve the view for the people who already live there because the folks who already live there don't want things built in their viewscape, well, the thing is, the house you're living in was probably built in somebody's viewscape who probably thought a big, beautiful field was more beautiful than a whole bunch of houses, you know, or an industrial plant where you may work and earn your living. Saying, gee, it's not very pretty to see a big industrial site or light industrial place, and yet the Tri-Cities are full of light industry, and aren't we glad that they're there because they provide a lot of employment. Coming up in a moment, do you remember Ashley Babbitt? The only person who was murdered on Capitol Hill on January 6th of last year, was there a legal justification to shoot her? We're going to dig deep into that coming up next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. I want to raise the question of Ashley Babbitt. Now, we've been talking about Ashley Babbitt since we first learned her name in January of last year. And why? Because of what happened on January the 6th, the riot at the Capitol building, and the fact that Ashley Babbitt was shot to death. She was shot one time by a Capitol cop. It took months before we could even find the name of the cop who did it. And then a lot of us began asking, was there any good legal reason to take her life? And I threw out the opinion, I've covered cop shootings for most of my career, for more than 40 years. And every time a cop shoots somebody, the first question is, was there good legal cause to do it? And I kept suggesting that I didn't think there was good legal cause. And I got people saying, well, you're not an expert on shootings and things. No, I'm not. I'm not. But I didn't think there was any reason to shoot Ashley Babbitt. And yet, the police officer involved, we now know his name, we know his rank, we know that he's had problems with guns before. He got cleared without even an investigation of any significant kind. Wasn't submitted to a grand jury or anything else. Well, Joe Hanneman, who's been looking into this for the Epoch Times, and he joins me now. Joe, thanks for taking the time today, because you've had the time to invest in looking deeply into the reasons for Ashley Babbitt, if there is a reason, for her to be shot to death by a Capitol cop and why he was cleared. Welcome back to the program, and I'll recommend people read the entire piece you wrote for Epoch Times. Thanks.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
So let's start with the essential question. Was there a determination about whether or not the lieutenant, the police officer in this case, Capitol cop, had any good legal reason to fire a shot and kill Ashley Babbitt?
Well, nothing that's been released publicly. I have asked for and the Department of Justice to provide whatever their written rationale was. Typically, in a case like this, there would be a very extensive case file and an analysis written by somebody, an attorney at the Justice Department, supporting whatever action or inaction they take. And there was a three-sentence memo that was issued to the Metro D.C. police back last spring, and it explained absolutely nothing. And there has not been anything from the U.S. Capitol Police either, because they did an internal review and cleared him to go back to work. But nothing that I've seen has been made public that would explain why they thought it wasn't any kind of a violation of law.
Does that match up with any other police-involved shootings that you've ever covered?
Well, I think it's very rare to see something like this where the shooter, in this case, lieutenant of Capitol
Lieutenant
Police
Byrd.
Lieutenant,
yeah.
Yes, is cleared without ever being interviewed. That's highly unusual, and I'm not sure why they didn't follow up and say, hey, you said you wanted a lawyer. Can we get your lawyer down here with you and do an interview? And as far as I know, that never happened. And that would have, I mean, he did go on television, but he did not sit down with the investigators from Internal Affairs who were in charge of the probe. And I do think that is an anomaly.
You know, Joe, the other thing I've often seen with police-involved shootings, and sometimes people are shocked that they're taken to a grand jury. I said, if I were a cop and I was in a situation like that, I'd want it to go to grand jury. So you could always say, well, this was put in front of either 7 or 14 or 21, members of the community. They looked at all the evidence presented to them, and they decided there was no case for bringing an indictment against me. In some ways, other than short of a jury trial, that's probably the best endorsement you could get that what you did was right. But it wasn't taken to grand jury either, was it?
Not that I know of. A lot of the January 6th defendants were charged with indictments that came from a grand jury. So Justice Department certainly used grand jury in a lot of instances for those who were accused of parading or vandalism or assault or other various things. In some states, you'd have at a county level or a state level, you'd have a coroner's inquest for something like this, where they would review a shooting, where there is testimony given in public so people can get a sense of what happened. And in this case, certainly has been secretive.
Yeah, it has been. In fact, I've even seen a coroner's an inquest into the death of somebody who died because he was put in a sleeper hold by the cops and then just never woke up. But you found out something. I'm talking to Joe Hanneman from the Epoch Times. You found out something about Ashley Babbitt's actions in the moments before she was shot to death that I've never heard reported anywhere else. What'd you find out?
Well, a few weeks ago, I started going back through the video that was shot in that hallway outside the speaker's lobby. And there were three men there who were journalists, or at least described themselves that way, that had fairly decent video equipment. And we went back through it frame by frame. And starting with the video shot by John Sullivan, and then going through two other men's videos. And it became very apparent that she was upset with the vandalism that was taking place. She was shouting at the rioters in the front row. In fact, at one point, she tried to physically get between the main, you know, the most active rioter and one of the police officers, and she tried to talk to him. And he put his arm up and blocked her away. And she stood down and then watched him drive his fist into the glass, and she flinched. And then after that happened, she turned on the police and started bawling them out. And she said, you know, call bleeping help. Basically, the implication being you're letting these guys do this. And the police were just standing there. I mean, those punches were going right by this officer's ear into the glass. And she was jumping up and down and looking for some kind of a reaction from them. And they didn't react. So she lit into them and called them frauds and some other things. And then she kind of got pushed out of the way by the main rioter. It's very clear to me that she was not there to try to egg them on or be part of any kind of an assault. And in fact, it was very upsetting to her.
Well, because it isn't that often that somebody gets shot to death at the U.S. Capitol, especially inside the building. None of this stuff has been reported until the story you did for Epoch Times, reports that this woman was doing all of these things prior to when she began to climb through that window for reasons we don't know. Did you get any insights as to why she was trying to climb through that broken window to the other side?
Well, it's all conjecture because we have no feedback from her. Although I did notice in one of the videos that she appeared to be filming with her own iPhone. And I understand from her husband that the FBI has never returned her phone to him. So there may be she may have shot some footage that would shed light on this. But Aaron, her husband, he is convinced that she looked around and saw the unfolding scene with the SWAT team coming up the stairs and, you know, probably 100 or more people packing into that hallway. And the police had stepped aside, and now that door was unguarded and three or four guys were absolutely wailing on it. And I think it's certainly a defensible theory that she panicked and said, I got to get out of here. Here's an opening. I'm going to take it.
Absolutely right. That's Joe Hanneman. He's a reporter for the Epoch Times. You can read the whole story as he wrote it up. Facts never before reported on the death of Ashley Babbitt. The man who killed her, and there's no doubt he killed her, faces no charges whatsoever. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the last 22 years and supplying honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. This segment of the show is brought to you by Marquee Hot Tubs. You'll get the ultimate hot tub and swim spa experience. Visit online or visit one of their three physical locations, MarqueeHotTubs.com. Our Twitter poll today, should the Supreme Court ban American colleges from giving preference based on skin color? So many of them do right now, and the Supreme Court announced just a few hours ago they will be hearing that case. We'll likely hear the decision on that case when the Supreme Court does its giant decision dump that usually comes in mid to late June of every year. But they're going to take up the case of Harvard and the University of North Carolina, although by extension, the result of that decision should extend to every single college in America. And I hope that what the Supreme Court decides is that you can't use race to determine whether or not somebody gets in. And you can't set different standards for incoming students based on whether or not they are Black, Hispanic, Asian, or white, and say we're going to have different standards depending on what your racial background is. I would love to hear a naysayer on that. I don't suspect that there are naysayers who want to defend that kind of Jim Crow idea. But if they are out there, 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. And by the way, I mentioned this earlier today, but I just want to reinforce the point. that homeless encampments of the kind that we've seen proliferate in the bigger cities of the Northwest, like Portland and Seattle, and to a lesser extent in the middle-sized cities throughout the Northwest, letting these homeless camps proliferate creates a clear and present danger to citizens. The latest example from late last week, a man who got into a dispute with a man at a homeless encampment. This was at Bellevue Place East on Seattle's Capitol Hill. One man shot the other man with a crossbow. And when the police arrived, they found a 30-year-old victim with a crossbow bolt sticking right out of his chest. And, you know, can you imagine this kind of danger? And yet with homeless encampments, the ability to make anybody, you know, responsible for what's going on and hold them responsible, very, very difficult to do. Second issue that I want to put in front of you, Mukilteo School District is now considering a proposal to remove a book that is currently being used in the classroom. And it's actually a classic book. I read it a long time ago in high school. It's called To Kill a Mockingbird. And it's a book about race. It's a book about rape. It's a book about so many very, very touchy subjects. And the school district had decided, well, we're not sure we want to use it anymore. This book, written by Harper Lee back in 1960, won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. But some of the characters, believe it or not, because of the time period it was written in, because of all these issues, some of the characters use some racist language. They use the N-word, for example. And the teachers cited concerns. Listen to this. Characters in the book frequently use the N-word, while no character explains that the slur is derogatory. Well, in the period of time in which the book was written and the story is told, the terminology was used, and I'm sure that there were some people who considered it derogatory. I've always considered it derogatory. I grew up as a little kid in the 1960s. I knew the word was off limits. And why? Because it was disgusting, because it disparaged people because of their skin color. But now you've got three teachers at one of the schools in the Mukilteo School District who've made the request to remove the novel from the required ninth grade curriculum. Even though you would think that these teachers would say there's a teaching opportunity or a learning opportunity in talking about this book, just like in talking about any of Mark Twain's books. I mean, ironically enough, he ended up using the N-word a lot in Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer, and yet he was a famous abolitionist. He believed that black people should be treated equitably in this country, and he wanted to see slavery abolished. He wrote at the time, which was a courageous thing to do. And yet they say, no, no, we don't want this book. You can have books about gay rights. You can have books about transgender. You can have books, and there are books being pressed on kids about various sensitive subjects, and some of them openly offensive subjects. But somehow this book, Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, written in 1960, written about issues of the day that are still clear and present in a different way today, and the teachers want the book banned from the classroom as part of the required curriculum. If that makes sense to you, please tell me why. I also want to mention this story out of Deschutes County very quickly. We'll probably bring it up tomorrow. They are now sending notices in the mail to teenagers who've been found guilty of crimes as teenagers. On their 18th birthday, they get a notice that say, you are now able to say that no juvenile record ever existed and no police contact ever occurred. It's by law, the Youth Expunction Reform Act, expunction, not exemption, deepens the dilemma for young people. Despite the fact that an expunged arrest never happened in the legal sense, it's still going to show up on federal criminal background checks. And you can bet that in the really high profile cases, it's going to turn up on internet searches. But we're now encouraging people who, as teenagers, committed crimes to run around and tell people, nope, I was never committed a crime. I never committed a crime. And in the eyes of the law, I never did anything wrong. And if that makes sense to you, I'd love to hear the naysayer call. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.